A month later, these German ships were themselves pounced upon by a British force, and all, except the Dresden, sunk by Admiral Sturdee in the Battle of the Falkland Isles. After this conflict, the Allies remained in undisputed possession of the surface of the sea, a supremacy which the great naval battle of Jutland on May 1, 1916, did nothing to shake. The Germans concentrated their attention more and more upon submarine warfare. From the beginning of the war, they had had considerable submarine successes. On one day, September 22, 1914, they sank three powerful cruisers, the Aboukir, the Hogue, and the Cressy, with 1,473 men. They continued to levy a toll upon British shipping throughout the war. At first they hailed and examined passenger and mercantile shipping, but this practice they discontinued for fear of traps, and in the spring of 1915 they began to sink ships without notice. In May 1915 they sank the great passenger liner, the Lusitania, without any warning, drowning a number of American citizens. This embittered American feeling against them, but the possibility of injuring and perhaps reducing Britain by a submarine blockade was so great that they persisted in a more and more intensified submarine campaign, regardless of the danger of dragging the United States into the circle of their enemies. Meanwhile, Turkish forces, very ill-equipped, were making threatening gestures at Egypt across the desert of Sinai. And while the Germans were thus striking at Britain, their least accessible and most formidable antagonist, through the air and under the sea, the French and British were also embarking upon a disastrous flank attack in the east upon the Central Powers through Turkey. The Gallipoli campaign was finely imagined but disgracefully executed. Had it succeeded, the Allies would have captured Constantinople in 1915. But the Turks were given 2 months' notice of the project by a premature bombardment of the Dardanelles in February. The scheme was also probably betrayed through the Greek court, and when at last British and French forces were landed upon the Gallipoli Peninsula in April, they found the Turks well entrenched and better equipped for trench warfare than themselves. The Allies trusted for heavy artillery to the great guns of the ships, which were comparatively useless for battering down entrenchments, and among every other sort of thing that they failed to foresee, they hadn't foreseen hostile submarines. Several great battleships were lost. They went down in the same clear waters over which the ships of Xerxes had once sailed to their fate at Salamis. The story of the Gallipoli campaign from the side of the Allies is at once heroic and pitiful, a story of courage and incompetence and of life, material, and prestige wasted, culminating in a withdrawal in January 1916. Linked up closely with the vacillation of Greece was the entry of Bulgaria into the war on October 12, 1915. The King of Bulgaria had hesitated for more than a year to make any decision between the two sides. Now, the manifest failure of the British at Gallipoli, coupled with a strong Austro-German attack in Serbia, swung him over to the Central Powers. While the Serbs were hotly engaged with the Austro-German invaders upon the Danube, he attacked Serbia in the rear, and in a few weeks the country had been completely overrun. The Serbian army made a terrible retreat through the mountains of Albania to the coast, where its remains were rescued by an Allied fleet. An Allied force landed at Salonika in Greece and pushed inland towards Monastir, but was unable to render any effectual assistance to the Serbians. It was the Salonika plan which sealed the fate of the Gallipoli expedition. To the east, in Mesopotamia, the British, using Indian troops chiefly, made a still remoter flank attack upon the Central Powers. An army, very ill provided for the campaign, was landed at Basra in the November of 1914 and pushed up towards Baghdad in the following year. It gained a victory at Ctesiphon, the ancient Arsacid and Sassanid capital, within 25 miles of Baghdad, but the Turks were heavily reinforced. There was a retreat to Kut, and there the British army, under General Townshend, was surrounded and starved into surrender on April the 29th, 1916. All these campaigns in the air, under the seas, in Russia, Turkey, and Asia, were subsidiary to the main front, the front of decision between Switzerland and the sea. And there the main millions lay entrenched, slowly learning the necessary methods of modern scientific warfare. There was a rapid progress in the use of the aeroplane. At the outset of the war, this had been used chiefly for scouting, and by the Germans for the dropping of marks for the artillery. Such a thing as aerial fighting was unheard of. In 1916, the aeroplanes carried machine guns and fought in the air. Their bombing work was increasingly important. They had developed a wonderful art of aerial photography, and all the aerial side of artillery work, both with aeroplanes and observation balloons, had been enormously developed. But the military mind was still resisting the use of the tank, the obvious weapon for decision in trench warfare. Many intelligent people outside military circles understood this quite clearly. The use of the tank against trenches was an altogether obvious expedient. Leonardo da Vinci invented an early tank, but what military expert has ever had the wits to study Leonardo? Soon after the South African War in 1903, there were stories in magazines describing imaginary battles in which tanks figured, and a complete working model of a tank made by Mr. J. A. Corrie of Leeds was shown to the British military authorities, who of course rejected it, in 1911. Tanks had been invented and reinvented before the war began, but had the matter rested entirely in the hands of the military, there would never have been any use of tanks. It was Mr. Winston Churchill, who was at the British Admiralty in 1915-16, who insisted upon the manufacture of the first tanks, and it was in the teeth of the grimmest opposition that they were sent to France. To the British Navy, and not to the Army, military science owes the use of these devices. The German military authorities were equally set against them. In July 1916, Sir Douglas Haig, the British Commander-in-Chief, began a great offensive which failed to break through the German line. In some places he advanced a few miles, in others he was completely defeated. There was a huge slaughter of the new British armies, and he did not use tanks. In September, when the season was growing too late for a sustained offensive, tanks first appeared in warfare. A few were put into action by the British in a not very intelligent fashion. Their effect upon the German was profound. They produced something like a panic, and there can be little doubt that had they been used in July in sufficient numbers and handled by a general of imagination and energy, they would have ended the war there and then. At that time the Allies were in greater strength than the Germans upon the Western Front. The odds were roughly 7-4. Russia, though fast approaching exhaustion, was still fighting. Italy was pressing the Austrians hard, and Romania was just entering the war on the side of the Allies. But the waste of men in this disastrous July offensive and the incompetence of the British military command brought the Allied cause to the very brink of disaster. Directly the British failure of July had reassured the Germans, they turned on the Romanians, and the winter of 1916 saw the same fate overtake Romania that had fallen upon Serbia in 1915. The year that had begun with the retreat from Gallipoli and the surrender of Kut ended with the crushing of Romania and with volleys fired at a landing party of French and British marines by a royalist crowd in the port of Athens. It looked as though King Constantine of Greece meant to lead his people in the footsteps of King Ferdinand of Bulgaria. But the coastline of Greece is one much exposed to naval action. Greece was blockaded, and a French force from Salonika joined hands with an Italian force from Valona to cut the King of Greece off from his Central European friends. In July 1917, Constantine was forced to abdicate by the Allies, and his son Alexander was made king in his place.